This is an encore presentation of the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. On this week's program, guerrilla fighters in the jungles of Aceh trade their army boots for hiking boots. Now they're leading tours, not raids.
It is very difficult to find a job in Aceh at the moment. I'm proud to work as a tour guide. Many people in the village ask me to bring them along because they also want to be guides.
Plus, a cure for high doctor bills in Senegal. And what's one part corn, one part chicken, one part veggies, and takes a whole village to make? It's an ancient Mayan dish, the tamale.
Families gather together. Some of them work on the sauce, some of them work on the dough, and everybody assembles them. And then you go out and give some to your neighbors, and they give some of theirs to you.
All that's ahead. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. It's a familiar story. People without health insurance don't get the care they need. And if they do get medical care, they struggle to pay the bills. We could be talking about any number of countries, including the United States. But this is Senegal in West Africa, where the vast majority of people are uninsured. Now there's a solution. From Dakar, Jordan Davis brings us the story.
On a street in a Dakar suburb, women kneel over washtubs. They laugh and sing as they rub out stains with their bare hands. Njemi Njai sells these neighborhood women bars of soap. She says she makes a profit of about 10 cents on each one.
You don't make much from it, but you can't sit and fold your hands either. There are kids to feed.
And medical expenses to pay. Those bills were especially worrisome, Njemi says, when she was about to deliver her third child.
That time was really difficult because I knew my husband didn't have any money and we were going to have a baby.
And Njemi's husband, Umar, runs a store out of a lean-to shack selling animal feed. The Njais can keep food on the table largely because they live in a relative's home, rent-free. So Umar says while his wife was in labor, he was frantically running around to friends and relatives asking to borrow money. It was a routine he knew only too well.
I can show you past medical bills from when I didn't have money at all. It was always very embarrassing. Your wife or your child is sick and you're confronted with this huge bill and you have to go and run to get money.
Umar Njai shuffles through a stack of crinkled prescriptions he's collected over the years, reading off the prices, all of them unfilled. The $10 or $20 was simply too much. But medical care is now less of a burden for the Njai family. They recently joined a so-called micro-insurance plan. It's like a stripped-down version of an HMO in the U.S. The family pays a monthly premium of $2.50. In turn, they get 70% of the cost of hospital and doctor's visits reimbursed. For the Njai family, the plan came in handy when baby number 4 came along.
When my last child was born, I didn't have money. But since I was already covered, when they gave me the bill, it went straight through the health plan. It was a big help because I didn't have to pay out of pocket.
The Njai family buys this insurance plan from a nonprofit organization called Pamikas. Matunya runs the local office of Pamikas. She says in the sprawling suburbs of cities like Dakar, people don't get to see the doctor much.
We recently offered a day of free medical consultations. It was scheduled from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. We were flooded with so many people, we had to stay until 8 that night. It shows there's a real lack of access to medical care.
Pamikas has been offering the micro-insurance plan for a year now. It funds the plan with money from development agencies and the profits from its microloan programs. Pamikas hopes the insurance program will one day become self-sufficient, with enough paying customers to fully cover insurance claims. But it's been slow to catch on. Nya says at her branch, only around 80 families have signed up.
People don't believe in it yet. It's not easy to change people's mentalities. There's not really a culture yet of thinking about your health before there's a crisis. People are coming, signing up little by little.
At the Njai house, husband Umar says scraping together the family's monthly premium of $250 is a struggle.
It requires a lot of sacrifices to come up with the money.
Children in Senegal routinely come down with malaria, yellow fever, and pneumonia. So wife Njeme says whatever the sacrifice, it's worth it.
All the time you're worried about what kind of treatment they'll get. So with this insurance plan, it's a big relief.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Jordan Davis in Dakar, Senegal.
Heard the phrase, location, location, location? Usually it refers to real estate, but we're still talking healthcare. Here now is our globe at a glance. In some parts of the world, local hospitals are staffed only by general practitioners and nurses. It's next to impossible, if you live in a remote area, to see a specialist. But in some African countries, that's changing. The Indian government has started a program linking hospitals in Ethiopia to hospitals with specialists in India. They're connected solely through the internet. This is how it works. A patient in rural Ethiopia visits his doctor at the local hospital. If that doctor needs advice, he arranges for a consultation with a specialist in India. The Ethiopian doctor puts the patient's x-rays and lab results up on the computer screen. Thousands of miles away in India, the same image appears on the specialist's computer screen. Then both doctors, one in India, one in Ethiopia, look at the x-rays together. They talk to each other about the patient, the diagnosis, and the best way to treat the problem. The patient benefits from the experience and expertise of the specialist, while the local African doctor learns new skills. 23 African countries have signed up to be part of this telemedicine revolution. Now patients can be treated by the best doctors available, regardless of where they live. And that's our Globe at a Glance. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer, and you're listening to the World Vision Report. Affordable health care is sometimes out of reach, even for the terminally ill. In Brownsville, Texas, there's a place for patients who are dying but can't afford hospice care. Will Everett brings us this story about Sunshine Haven and the nurse who founded it.
Lois Del Castillo was head of the nursing department at a Brownsville hospital when she made a discovery that changed the course of her career.
I had the habit of making rounds every morning when I went on duty. I walked in, stepped off the elevator one morning, and there was a light at the far end of the hall. And this is where terminally ill patients are relegated.
It was a terminally ill patient calling for a nurse.
I walked past the desk with seven staff members sitting around BSing and totally ignoring the buzzer, the light. Walked in that room and the man was dead with a call button in his hand. How long he had been dead, I have no idea, but he was very dead. I was so angry that morning that they still remember it.
She realized the terminally ill were being cared for in hospitals that didn't want them or at home by family members who couldn't take care of them. So she started Sunshine Haven, a special care facility that provides a quiet, home-like environment for dying patients. When it opened 8 years ago, applications started coming in from all over South Texas, an area plagued with rural poverty.
And I took one man out of a chicken coop. No electricity, no running water. His bed was four cement blocks with a piece of plywood and an old mattress. No sheets, no pillows.
Patients are never charged a dime to stay at Sunshine Haven. Families are simply asked to give what they can. When patients pass away, relatives often agree to set up a memorial fund and ask that donations be sent to Sunshine Haven in lieu of flowers. The hospice operates out of a residential subdivision 10 miles outside of Brownsville. From the outside, it looks like just another house on the block. The only giveaway is the regular arrival of ambulances bringing the patients in and the hearses that carry them away.
Patient that's coming in will be in this room.
Residents and visitors hang out in the living room or sit on the screened back porch and watch the birds. Sunshine Haven has 11 beds, so there's always a waiting list. A room became available when a patient passed away this morning. Within a few hours, the bed will be occupied by an AIDS patient. There's a flurry of activity as the staff gets the room in order.
The ambulance is on its way.
Oh, you're kidding.
Oh, I need to move. Probably.
Soon the ambulance arrives. Sorry. The patient is rolled in on a gurney.
Yeah, all the way back to the left.
Del Castillo says a growing percentage of patients here are undocumented aliens from south of the border.
It doesn't make any difference to me whether they're legal or illegal. They're still human beings that are very deserving, and that's, I don't care. I don't care what their status is.
And many patients are homeless. Joey De La Garza is the executive director of Sunshine Haven.
We just recently had a gentleman who used to sell newspapers down here, maybe 2 miles away. He used to dance on the streets, selling his selling gimmick. And all this time he was doing this, he had lung cancer. 3 weeks later, he's laying on one of our beds, taking his last breath. He'd probably be sitting under an expressway, an overpass, by himself, maybe found days later after he passed away.
De La Garza says his first day at work was the worst day of his life. That was the day Sunshine Haven got its youngest terminally ill patient. When the paperwork hit his desk, he thought there had been a typo.
Deep back in my mind, I was hoping, I hope this is not a newborn baby. And sure enough, it was. About 2-3 hours later, here comes this young man with this baby who was in a comatose state, not eating, not responding.
The baby was born with anencephaly, meaning most of his brain was missing. The mother had abandoned the infant and the teenage father. With a mountain of unpaid hospital bills, the father had nowhere to go, so Sunshine Haven took him in.
And he was losing his home. And we let him stay here for several months while the baby was here with us.
People ask De La Garza how he can work with the dying day in and day out. He says it's just something you get used to.
I'm just here as a facilitator to help transition into the next level of life. It's not a sad thing. To me, it's a positive thing.
Lois Del Castillo sits in a rocker on the screened back porch. The AIDS patient that was brought in last night just passed away. She's sorry he didn't have more time.
My philosophy is allowing people to live life to the fullest, to the very end, and that's what Sunshine Haven is really all about.
She says if she can give a patient just a few hours of peace before leaving this world, her mission has been accomplished. For the World Vision Report, this is Will Everett in Brownsville, Texas.
That's the sound of tamales sizzling in a pan. Join us in the kitchen of a Guatemalan cook just after this short break. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. In many Mexican towns and villages, the young men and women are missing. They've migrated north in search of well-paying jobs. Many hope to return when they've built up their savings. In the meantime, those who are still at home have to cope with the loneliness of being left behind. From the small town of Monte Blanco, Conrad Fox reports on a group of women who have found a way to express how they feel.
A crowd of 30 or so people are gathered in an empty front room of an old house, looking at black and white photos on the walls. There's never been a photo exhibition in this tiny, working-class village before. And until recently, the 9 local women whose work is on display had never held a camera. The exhibition is the culmination of a course sponsored by the Rockefeller Foundation. Its goal? To teach the women to use photography to explore a theme that touches this community deeply. Migration. 22-year-old Itzel Hernandez is one of the women whose work is on display. She stands in front of her photo of 2 old men seated on a wall.
A mí me encanta los señores, las caras que
tienen. I love their faces. I don't know what they're talking about, but it would be interesting to listen in.
Behind them in the distance is a large, half-built house. She points to one of the men.
Siempre está sentado fuera de su casa, solo.
He's always sitting here, alone. His hands are worn and calloused. His face is hard. It's that of a campesino farmer. And in the back, there's this big house that's being built with money sent back by migrants in the U.S. His house is just tiny, poor.
There's a sadness in this photo, and in all the others. You can see old people or kids sitting alone. Discarded toys, empty streets. Even the family gatherings have something missing. Young people. An estimated 30% of the population, mostly young men and women, have left the village in search of work in the U.S. or northern cities of Mexico. Migration has brought much-needed money to some people in Monte Blanco, but it's brought sadness, too.
My sisters left for Monterey, and it was like the house was left empty. We used to sleep all in one room, laughing, joking all night. Then suddenly there was nothing. There was no one to talk to. There was always an empty place at the dinner table.
Not all the women deliberately sought to capture sadness in their photos. 45-year-old Edith Peña had never held a camera before, and just taking photos of children in her family was a new experience. She shows a photo of a young girl, her granddaughter, posing shyly for the camera.
I took this because she was just a baby when her father had to leave. Her father's far away now. Her father isn't seeing her grow up. How she began to walk, now she's talking.
Edith's mother, Erlinda, stares at the photo of the young girl and grows teary-eyed. She says she communicates frequently with one of her sons in the U.S. by phone, letter, and even internet. But now they've got the photos, she says, it's added a whole new dimension to staying in touch.
He's always asking to see photos of the nephews, to see them growing up. It's not the same by computer or by phone. You want to see them, and you can't.
Most of the women say they want to continue with photography. That might be impossible right now. None has the money to buy her own camera. Itzel has been so inspired by the course, she says, she wants to study journalism. But to pay for her studies and a camera of her own, she says she'll have to migrate north to work for a while.
In your heart, you know there's no other solution. Because staying here, I can't go to university. I can't work to pay for my studies. So I've got to leave. If I want to get ahead, I know it hurts me, but I've got to leave my family.
But unlike so many of the young people who have left Monte Blanco, Itzel says she hopes she'll come back eventually to live here. For the World Vision Report, I'm Conrad Fox in Monte Blanco, Veracruz State, Mexico.
Like the migrants from Monte Blanco, many Mexicans who come to work in the U.S. send a good portion of their paychecks back home. Most of them use Western Union to transfer their money. The company used to be known for its telegram service, but when telegrams died out, the company almost went bankrupt. It's doing much better now. There are more Western Unions around the world than McDonald's, Walmart, Starbucks, and Burger King combined. And the company is worth billions of dollars, mostly thanks to migrants sending money to their families. Jason DeParle covered this story for the New York Times.
Globally, migrants send home about $300 billion a year, which is more than three times the combined foreign aid budgets of the world. So when you think about the amount of money that flows from the rich world to the poor world, remittances, the money that migrants send home, is that's really where the action is. And Western Union has by far the largest market share of any money-sending company. It's four times larger than its closest competitor. Western Union controls about one-seventh of the remittance market.
And Jason, when you travel around the world as a reporter for the New York Times, is it easy to find a Western Union?
Yeah, that's what got me interested in the story initially. I was in rural Nepal. We had flown to Kathmandu and driven about 12 hours outside Kathmandu. And you know, it was one of those places where I really thought I had found the end of the earth. And we got to a small hostel late at night. It was dark. And when I woke up and looked out the window in the morning, there was a Western Union sign across the street.
Really? So they're everywhere.
They're not owned by Western Union. They're kind of like franchisees. They're agents. So often they're located in other organizations, like the Chinese Post Office is an agent of Western Union or the Indian Post Office. So any place there's an Indian Post Office, there's a Western Union office.
What are the fees? Let's say a migrant worker in New York City wants to send $100 home to Mexico. What does he have to pay in fees to Western Union to do that?
It very much depends on where you're sending from and where you're sending to, and it depends on who's across the street to compete. The rates change constantly. It can be as low as 3 or 4% and as high as 30%.
And has there been much complaint on the part of migrant groups about these fees? I mean, I would imagine that over a year's time, by the time you add up the fees these people pay, how much work does a migrant worker have to do just to cover his fees to Western Union?
Right. A lot of the advocacy groups have been critical, not only for the extent of the fees, but for the way the fees are set up. There's a big lawsuit against Western Union 7 or 8 years ago that said it was insufficiently disclosing its fees. Two things happened. One was increased competition. A number of other money transfer companies cropped up in, to compete with Western Union, so the fees have been coming down. There were a lot of critics of Western Union who said, gee, it's taking advantage of poor people. You know, this amounts to a kind of invisible tax on the poorest immigrants, on their hard-won earnings. On the other hand, there's always been a paradox, which is that the people who use the service by and large like it. And one of the reasons they like it is because they trust it. They know that the money's going to get there. So yes, it's expensive, but it's reliable. The main alternative before Western Union was giving it to a friend, handing $300 to a friend or a relative or your brother-in-law who you thought was going home to Mexico, and you would hope that the money got there, but it, you know, lots of ways it could have gotten lost along en route. Western Union, you can walk in, you can give $300, and before you leave the store, your relative can be standing at a Western Union outlet in Mexico, and you know, you both walk out of the office at the same time with knowing the money's gotten there.
Most Americans use banks to transfer money. What does Western Union offer that banks don't?
Sometimes they're cheaper, sometimes they're not, but you have to have a bank account. So lots of immigrants don't have bank accounts.
Now, Jason, you mentioned that there had been a lot of criticism, and still is, I'm sure, of Western Union charging these fees, some of them very high, for immigrants to send money home. And as a response to that criticism, they've actually taken some steps to show themselves as good global citizens. What actually has Western Union done as a company to reach out to migrant groups?
There's a Western Union Foundation. They've done a lot with disaster relief, hurricanes, typhoons, particularly, you know, in developing countries when they come through and cause so much damage. Western Union is known, I think, for contributing to disaster relief.
Jason, on this show, we have covered cell phones as a new mode of money transfer, especially in Africa. How significant do you think this competition will be?
The people who follow Western Union are very divided over that. Some think it could be the equivalent of email and put them out of business in money transfer the way email put them out of business in telegrams. And the other people, the skeptics on that, argue that new technologies have been threatening the money transfer business for a decade. You know, the internet, sending money over to computers, and that in the end you still need a point of cash to get the money onto the phone. Just like you need a bank account to use a bank, you still need a place to go and put the money in and get the money out, and that only Western Union's got that global network.
Interesting. All right, Jason DeParle, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
My pleasure.
Jason DeParle is a reporter for the New York Times. We spoke to him from Washington, D.C. Latino immigrants abroad often long for the food of their homeland, and tiendas, or food stores, have sprung up on street corners in the towns where migrants have settled. Tamales are a favorite at the tiendas. They originated with ancient Mayan culture that ranged from southern Mexico to Central America. The recipe has survived for thousands of years. Melissa De Leon wants to make sure it lives on for a few more. De Leon is an instructor at a cooking school in Antigua, Guatemala. She teaches tourists and food aficionados how to make tamales. Reporter Amelia Shaw brings us this installment in our ongoing series, What's Cooking?
Melissa De Leon stands with four students over a large gas stove, where she points out the vegetables she's roasting.
Roma tomatoes, red bell pepper, white onion, garlic, mil tomate, or tomatillos, and this is for the sauce of tamales.
Her assistant pours water and oil into a big pot of cornmeal. She works hard to stir the sticky mixture that forms the main ingredient in tamales. The soft cornmeal will eventually be stuffed with various fillings, topped with roasted chili sauce, then wrapped in leaves. As De Leon sears chunks of chicken for the filling, I ask her about the history of tamales.
Tamales are an ancient dish made by Mayans, and Mayans used to make them with corn. Then the recipe was modified in colonial times by the Spaniards, and they brought a lot of ingredients that were added into tamales, like olives and capers and chicken.
And for somebody who's never seen what a tamale looks like, what can you describe it? What does it look like?
Yes, it's like a small square package because we use two types of leaves. So the stronger leaves go outside and banana leaves go inside. And you grab it like a present, then you tie it with a bow.
And then what do you do with it? How do you cook it?
You steam them.
And how do Guatemalans eat tamales? Do they eat them every day or...?
No, they're made every Saturday. Families gather together, so they would have a tamal every Saturday. And they're also the traditional Christmas meal. So it's like a ceremony making them. Families gather together also. They would make like 200 tamales. So some of them work on the sauce, some of them work on the dough, and everybody assembles them. And then you go out and give some to your neighbors, and they give some of theirs to you.
It sounds almost like a community event.
It is. It is.
Now, if I come to visit Guatemala or Antigua, where could I find tamales to buy them, and how much would they cost?
About a dollar. All over Guatemala, you'll find little stores that we call tiendas. And whenever they have tamales on Saturday, they will have a red light outside. So you'll know they have tamales.
We have enough tamales.
Okay.
De Leon stands over the stove and passes what look like large palm leaves through an open flame.
We are putting the machan leaves through the flame to make them soft. So when we are assembling tamales, the leaves won't break.
Her students stand ready to wrap their stuffed cornmeal in banana and machan leaves. De Leon, like most Guatemalan women, learned how to make tamales from her grandmother. For her, sharing the recipe with her students is just one more way to keep this tradition alive. For the World Vision Report, I'm Amelia Shaw in Antigua, Guatemala.
La Paz is a city notorious for its bad traffic. The laws of the road are constantly violated by both cars and pedestrians. So officials in the Bolivian capital have come up with a novel way to solve their traffic jams. It involves teenagers dressed as zebras. They're stationed at some of La Paz's busiest intersections. Reporter Ruxandra Guidi explains.
Cars, buses, and street vendors all vie for a place on the crowded streets of La Paz. To make matters even more chaotic, pedestrians cross wherever it's most convenient for them. And even if they do cross at a red light, most drivers don't slow down. Drivers also don't stop for pedestrians in painted crosswalks, also known here as zebras. So 2 years ago, the city officials came up with an idea: hire some zebras as crosswalk guards. Actually, hire unemployed poor teens and dress the kids up in zebra costumes. Patricia Grossman is the director of city culture for La Paz.
We were looking for a friendly solution without any coercion or fines or police. That's how the zebra came about. At first, our program was very criticized. Everyone thought we were abusing the kids inside the zebra costumes. But we paid them, and they were so motivated. That's how we started to realize that we could change people's attitudes by being friendly.
The zebra costume looks like striped pajamas with footsies, with the addition of an enormous zebra head. I spent a half hour observing the zebras in action on Avenida Mariscal Santa Cruz, the busiest avenue in La Paz.
There's probably around 5 or 6 zebras here, all trying to regulate the traffic and tell bus drivers to stop at the corner and not just anywhere in the middle of the street. And I'm standing next to this one zebra that's basically telling people to just cross on the crosswalk.
Sometimes the zebras will actually take an elderly woman by the arm and carry children across the street. Or they might extend a rope or tube along the intersection to make traffic stop for people. But despite this, the zebras don't always get respect. Ramiro Bautista is a 16-year-old high school student. He's standing at the edge of the sidewalk asking people to cross at the crosswalk and yelling at bus drivers to drop off passengers at their designated stops.
Further down the street on the corner is the bus stop, but they're getting off the buses here. That's why we're yelling at them. They don't listen to us. Some of the taxis do, but for the most part, no one listens to us.
Bautista's daily shift lasts about 4 to 6 hours. For that, he makes between $5 to $8, depending on the intersection he's assigned. The poorest here make much less. Still, it's not exactly great pay. Zebra job applicants don't have to prove that they're poor. But in Bolivia, there's a strong stigma associated with working on the street, so only young men and women who really need a job will apply to become a zebra. On this day, more than a dozen zebras are meeting up at a park in downtown La Paz for one of their many awareness campaigns. Aside from their costumes, they've brought a band to draw the attention of passersby. Tania Rodriguez is one of the zebras on shift. She says that she loves her job, both for the experience and the money. But, she adds, the work isn't easy.
I do feel like I'm in danger sometimes, because the cars are always driving right next to me or behind me. One time, a minibus hit me with its door. So yes, we are often at risk of getting hurt, because the drivers don't take our work seriously.
And not all pedestrians fully appreciate their work. Diana Flores is on her way home from the office. She says that for the most part, she thinks the zebras are doing a good job.
They help a lot. They keep accidents from happening, and they control the traffic. Just now, I did what they asked me to, but I don't always. If I'm rushing somewhere, then I don't listen to the zebras.
But city officials say more and more people are starting to obey the zebras, and the program has drawn the attention of other congested cities like Cochabamba and Santa Cruz. Officials there would like to try out the program, so they've asked La Paz to send them some zebra costumes. For the World Vision Report, I'm Ruxandra Guidi, La Paz, Bolivia.
Guerrilla fighters in Indonesia turn their attention to tourists, but it's not as bad as it sounds. That's coming next on the World Vision Report. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. When we hear the word Aceh, most Americans think of the tsunami that struck there in 2004. But this Indonesian province has also experienced a man-made disaster, nearly 30 years of civil war. A peace agreement was signed in 2005, and now a tour company there is hiring former rebels as guides. They take tourists deep into the jungle to explore former guerrilla hideouts. From Aceh, Chad Bouchard filed this report.
A stocky man dressed in threadbare shorts and an oil-stained t-shirt hacks his way through the jungle with a curved machete. Like many Indonesians, Don uses only one name. The last time he walked this overgrown mountain trail, he was under fire and on the run from his own government. 3 years after the end of that bloody conflict, Don finds himself pausing on the steep mountain slope, waiting for a handful of winded tourists to catch up.
This is really steep.
Don and his brother Yuni were foot soldiers in a guerrilla independence movement called GAM. They are the last generation to fight a brutal civil war spanning three decades. Now they've traded in their arms for brand new hiking boots, working as mountain guides for an adventure tour company. The mountaineering and survival skills that once helped them outmaneuver the Indonesian army now come in handy as they march groups of curious foreigners into the same jungle. On this day, the hikers are aid workers who live in the nearby provincial capital of Banda Aceh. For about $100, they get a day trip into the vast wilderness that was until recently off-limits to travelers because of the conflict. Some want a glimpse of the local wildlife, honey bears, hornbills, monkeys. Others want to know the personal stories of former rebels to get a sense of their lives as fugitives. Don and Yuni answer our questions about that time cautiously. They're especially reluctant to talk about current politics. Their memories of combat are fresh. Yuni recalls one day of particularly fierce fighting.
Itu yang paling lama yang saya alami kontak tu.
It was the longest combat with the enemy that I have ever experienced. I was here at dawn, around 6 in the morning. It was dark. I couldn't see anything. The army attacked us from over there.
In December 2004, things were looking very bad for the exhausted mountain rebels. Yuni's brother Don points out a thick bluish scar where a bullet grazed his arm.
The enemy was close, about 15 meters. I didn't have any weapon that day. The army got to the location before us. I did not have a weapon, and they just opened fire. I jumped, forgot to pull in my hand, and got hit over here.
Just a few days after Don was shot, the massive tsunami scoured nearby shores and changed everything in its wake. A few weeks later, a peace deal was finally brokered between the two battered sides, but thousands of ex-combatants were left with few skills to earn a living. Reconstruction temporarily pumped millions of aid dollars into the local economy, but when the aid money dried up, jobs were even harder to find. So Don is grateful for the opportunity he has now.
It is very difficult to find a job in Aceh at the moment. I'm proud to work as a tour guide. Many people in the village ask me to bring them along because they also want to be guides. The salary is good. This job is different than other jobs. We only have to take tourists up a mountain.
Okay, guys, please don't step on the barbed wire.
Mendel Poles, a Dutch citizen, is the founder of Aceh Explorer Adventure Tours, the company that runs these tours. He has hired more than 20 of the former rebels as guides.
The fact that they are former GAM combatants perhaps adds a little to the flavor of the overall jungle experience that we are doing today. On the other hand, I also realized that perhaps after a few years, if the peace is lasting, perhaps nobody would care anymore that the guide is a former combatant or he's just somebody from a village who just knows, who happens to know a nice trail. Time will tell.
One Norwegian on the tour, Helena Tiedemann, says visiting soldiers' hideouts was haunting, sometimes eerie.
It's really hard to imagine what they've been through. Being with these guides, telling us the stories and... You know, it's kind of a mix of feelings, because it's, for me it's an adventure to see this, but at the same time, it's also, a really brutal history, so, yeah.
The tour group reaches a small cave once used as a rebel lookout. Yuni finds a giant wok tucked away in the bushes. He recalls cooking for scores of soldiers in that camp. For weeks, the group lived on just one bag of rice and wild plants.
As I sit by myself in the village, I sometimes remember the things that we have gone through when we lived in the forest. They are sweet and bitter memories. Sometimes my wife asks me about that time. I tell her everything. But it can be difficult to talk about it. We were very hungry.
Asked if he feels uncomfortable giving away his best hiding spots to tourists, Yuni looks at his brother and with a nervous laugh explains that they are keeping secret plenty of hiding places deeper in the jungle, just in case. For the World Vision Report, I'm Chad Bouchard in Aceh, Indonesia.
Jungles can harbor more than gorilla hideouts. Many are home to exotic animals, including elephants. But people have been moving farther and farther into elephant territory, cutting down the forest to build farms, roads, and towns. The elephants have to go farther afield to search for food, and they often end up invading the villages. Matthew Lewis is with the World Wildlife Fund. The organization has been working in Asia and Africa to prevent what it calls human-elephant conflict. He says the problem begins when elephants are fenced into small tracts of forest.
These are... unfortunately, usually the poorest people who suffer because it's small settlements made of mud houses or bamboo houses, houses which are very easy for elephants to destroy. So elephants will come out of these habitats looking for food. They'll run into a house, a settlement, knock down the houses. In some cases in Asia, elephants are looking for salt. So the first place that they attack when they come into a house is to look for the kitchen area, and they search for the salt or sugar or some of these very sweet things that they're that they're drawn to.
You mean somebody can be in their small house cooking in the kitchen and suddenly an elephant barges in?
It's usually after dark. Elephants are most active at night. In some cases, it's people who are just cooking their evening meal sitting in the kitchen, and all of a sudden the wall is knocked down by an elephant who's searching for some salt or a pinch of sugar. Sort of like the neighbor you don't want to come over to borrow a cup of sugar, if you will.
I guess if that's happening, people are being hurt, maybe killed.
Yes, unfortunately, in most instances, people are killed. If they're not killed directly by the elephants, then they're killed as the house is knocked down around them. Or they're killed when they try to drive away the elephants and the elephants retaliate against them through fear.
You've talked about them breaking into the houses, which is very dramatic. But I understand that the elephants are also destroying crops that maybe a farmer has been growing for a year. And right before harvest, the elephants come in herds and eat all of it. Is that what's happening?
Yes, that happens quite often. And it's a situation where these are mostly subsistence farmers. They're depending on one crop of whether it be rice or corn or something like that. And that whole crop determines their livelihood for the year. And in one fell swoop, a herd of elephants can come in overnight and completely destroy a crop.
So this is really a troubling standoff. I mean, the elephants have to find food. The people have to grow their food. It's really tough to find a solution to this problem, isn't it?
Right. The way World Wildlife Fund approaches this issue is from two perspectives. You have, on the short term, solutions that we can do to try to de-escalate the violence. And on the long term, the solution has to lie in better land use planning.
Well, let's talk about some of the short-term solutions you mentioned.
Yes. One of the short-term solutions is using deterrents, things that will try to persuade elephants not to raid this particular farm. What you do is use chili peppers, locally grown hot chilies, and elephants are particularly sensitive to hot chili. They have large trunks, which are very sensitive. In those trunks, they have very, very many nerve endings to sense smells. And it seems that chili powder is something that irritates the heck out of elephants when they get a whiff of it. So what we do is to use chili peppers, dry them, grind them up into chili powder, and then either turn them into a paste using used, in a lot of cases, used motor oil. You can also use used cooking oil to form sort of a grease, a paste, which you apply to a rope, and you string these ropes around a farm, sort of like a fence. And when elephants come near it, they don't want to cross it because they can smell the chili powder, and it's very irritating to them, and they, in most cases, go the other way.
So this sounds like a pretty simple solution.
It's very simple, it's very low-tech, and it's easily taught from one farmer to another. It's not a system where we have to go out and teach every single farmer how to do this. And another use of chili powder is forming chili smoke bombs, where the chili is mixed with elephant dung, dried and formed into a brick, and then ignited with charcoal or something like that, and left to smolder, and the burning smoke from that is also a very big irritant to elephants. And those smoking chili bombs, when placed around the edge of a farm, also serve to deter elephants from raiding farms.
Now, elephants are known to be pretty smart. They're known for their intelligence. Do they ever figure out a way to get around these chili barriers?
They do, and that's why this is really just a short-term solution. It's a constant battle between humans and elephants to outwit each other. Humans put up chili ropes. They work for a while. Elephants avoid them. But we've seen one very amusing example in northern Mozambique where a young male elephant figured out very quickly that he could pick up a log with his trunk and toss it at the fence and knock the fence down, and then he could walk right over it. And he figured that out pretty quickly. And then it seemed like he went back and taught the rest of his herd how to do it, because right after he did that, we were seeing all the fences destroyed in the same way. They would all have a log laying on them.
Oh, my goodness. Now, and I heard there's another short-term solution, and that involves using Asian domesticated elephants to drive out their wild cousins. How does this work?
What it does is brings villagers together around a team of domesticated elephants and villagers on foot. And it forms squads then that can be placed in strategic areas around a village to protect it or around a plantation. And when elephants come out of the forest to try to raid those crops, the squad of people and elephants together drive it back. And that's been very successful. This has two advantages. One is that we are putting to use domesticated elephants, which in a lot of cases in Asia have been put out of work due to logging bans and items such as that. In Indonesia, for example, domesticated elephants are often kept in labor camps under pretty poor conditions. So we're able to put them to work and treat them very well.
You mean the wild elephants are afraid of the domesticated elephants? They don't take them on? They don't challenge them?
Very, very rarely, actually. Most of the time, the wild elephants run away. They almost never stand and fight. mostly because it's a very odd thing that's coming at them. It's humans riding on elephants together with a line of humans on the ground, and they're making all the noise that they can manage. They're using firecrackers, they're using noise-making cannons, they're yelling and clapping and singing sometimes, and throwing firecrackers. So it's a really, it's a chaotic situation. And the wild elephant's first reaction is usually run away, run the other direction.
If you're using these deterrents, and you are indeed pushing back these herds of elephants, I have to wonder what happens to the elephants. They go back into the forest. They can't invade the crops. So do they just starve? Where are they going to find food?
That's a very good point. And that's why I stress that this is only a short-term solution. We can drive the elephants back into the forest. But as you said, if they don't have enough food, they have to find it somewhere else. Of course, as I mentioned, over the very long term, we have to have smart land use planning. Countries that have elephants that are elephant range states need to do long-term planning to make sure that elephant habitat is secure in ample amounts and that is connected by corridors through which elephants are free to move without encountering people.
All right. Matthew Lewis with the World Wildlife Fund. Thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
Matthew Lewis is a program officer with the World Wildlife Fund. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C. Matthew would probably agree that it's preferable to see large wild animals at a distance, like from a jeep. Tourists from around the world head to the Masai Mara to do just that. The reserve in Kenya is famous for its natural beauty and abundance of game. But the violence that followed Kenya's contested presidential election late last year has meant a dramatic drop in the number of people visiting. Now the Mara Conservancy, which manages part of the park, has come up with an innovative solution to raise funds. Richard Locke has this reporter's notebook.
Joseph Kimojino sits at his laptop, dressed in a camouflage jacket and green beret. It's a painful experience watching him enter the latest entry to his blog with the punch of a single finger. Kimojino is a ranger with the Mara Conservancy. His official title is warden in charge of anti-animal harassment. He tells me that means it's his job to prevent tourists throwing stones at lions to make them move, or stopping photographers from luring cheetahs in closer with food. But when you visit the Masai Mara now, it's painfully obvious that Western safari goers are giving the park a wide berth. So far this year, there have been virtually no tourists for Kimojino to monitor, and since January, the Mara Conservancy has faced a monthly shortfall of $50,000. So Kimojino has a new day job, writing a blog called Mara Triangle to draw attention to the crisis in the Masai Mara and to raise cash. The Conservancy has just barely managed to pay the rangers their salaries, but it's had to cut back its anti-poaching patrols because it can't afford the fuel. And it's suspended a cattle compensation program that pays local Masai for livestock lost to lions and leopards. Kimojino's typing is a slow process, but I remind myself that he's a park ranger, not a speed typing secretary, and until a few months ago was computer illiterate. He had a Yahoo account, but no idea how to access it. He shifts his stare from the keyboard to take me through his latest posting.
The posting itself is about an incident that took place in the park, and some poachers sneaked into the park during the night and managed to kill 37 Thompson gazelles before they were arrested. Six of them were arrested. There were so many. And they were using dogs and torches to kill these animals.
Kimojino is now hooked on blogging. He writes about the wildlife in the Mara. For example, the fatal poisoning of two lions a few weeks ago. And it seems his audience is addicted to his blog. He regularly receives 500 hits a day from readers all over the world, especially the United States and Europe. 500 hits a day, that's incredible. I write my own blog, and I'm green with envy. What's more, his readers are donating considerable sums of money.
We managed to raise $47,000. The money that paid the salaries, almost 50% of the money came from the blog, which is very incredible.
In fact, the money Kimojino's raising is keeping the Mara Conservancy operational. It costs $1,000 just to finance a ranger for 2 months.
And now, luckily, we have 15 rangers sponsored. So the blog itself is doing something very great.
So it's thanks to your blog that the Conservancy has been able to continue with anti-poaching patrols, I ask Kimojino. He nods bashfully. He agrees that it's the response from strangers that drives him on. It's clear to me he feels he owes it to his donors to show them where their money's going.
I feel motivated and I feel like going on. I will not stop. Most important is that we are telling them now that their money they've given us is really working.
The Masai Mara cannot afford for him to stop either. A couple of weeks ago, armed raiders from Tanzania shot a ranger twice in their leg as they stole cattle owned by local Maasai. He's had to be airlifted to a hospital. So now the Mara Conservancy faces a bill of more than $10,000. So I let Kimojina return to his one finger typing.
Richard Locke is the World Vision Report's Africa correspondent. He's based in Nairobi. And that's it for this week. If you want to know more about our program or any of the stories we've featured on the show, check out our website at worldvisionreport.org. You can listen to the show there and see photos of some of the people and places you've heard about today. And we have a link there so you can podcast the show and take us with you. Our production team includes Beverly Abel, Chris Baldiga, Mark Bandy, Doug Boyles, Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, Lita Hartman, Sue Shepard, Diane Toomey, and I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.